hi. What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the podcast, Lead Singer Syndrome. I'm your host, as always, Shane Told, taking you into the backstage conversations that I have with other lead singers about what it's like to do the thing. And oh, we got a good one today, man. I talked to a real rock star, a veteran, Nick Hexum of 311. Been doing it for almost 30 years. What an incredible career, and really not a typical career. They came out swinging, they had huge hits out of the gate, but they've turned that into an absolutely amazing cult following. We talk about their consistency that they've managed to have, headlining amphitheaters, doing cruises, having 311 day, all this stuff that they do all the time, and this was a very, very cool conversation. Thank you for taking time out of your very busy, I'm sure, schedule. I don't know what you're up to. Maybe you're working. Maybe you're sitting around like me. Regardless, I hope you are staying safe, doing the proper social distancing. And maybe, just maybe, we're starting to see a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. I don't know. I'm being optimistic. Anyway, hey, remember, you can always get in touch with me if you're bored. Write me an email. I'm bored. I will read it. LeadSingerSyndrome@gmail.com. I read everything. You can also add me on social media. It is at Shane Told, and you can add the podcast at LeadSingerSyndrome on Instagram or at LeadSingerSyn, S-Y-N, on Twitter. And we are on Facebook. Yes, Facebook still a thing. In fact, I want to thank everyone who tuned in to my live stream that I did on the Silverstein Facebook last week. It was awesome. We had like, 7,000 people watching me just in my living room playing a bunch of Silverstein tunes. That was really, really rad and fun. You know, it's weird to like be in my living room playing songs like I do all the time, but typically I'm just like fucking around. I don't really care. I'm not trying to do it well. You know, I'm sometimes changing the words to like dick and fart jokes. Like I have to stop myself and be like, oh yeah, that little tiny thing on the computer is a camera and thousands of people are watching me. So I better, you know, do my best. So thank you everybody that tuned in for that. I hope I can do lots more live streams. I do live streams pretty regularly. And members of the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club will know that. What is the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club, you ask? Well, if you've listened to all 219 of these things and you want more and you want more interaction with me, you want to be part of an amazing community of like-minded people and fans of the show all over the world, and you want to get some stuff shipped to you, it is what helps keep this thing going week after week, even during the apocalypse. That's right. That's the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. For as little as $6 a month, you can sign up. And it's really, really great. It's really, really fun. I assure you of it. So check it out, leadsingersyndrome.com/all access. That's the link. And that will get you in. In other news with me, well, I'm making some great soup. I've made about 8 or 9 different soups, and I'm feeling really, really good about my soup game. Yes. That's what this has come to. I don't know. Maybe I'll start another podcast about soup. Hey, if you want soup recipes, send me an email. Anyway, here's my conversation with Nick Hexum of 311.
Hello.
Hey, Nick. What's up, man?
How you doing?
Well, probably about the same as everybody else on the planet, you know?
Total chaos, yeah.
Right? Like, I almost need to say, usually when I do these things, I don't give people listening like a context of a date. You know what I mean? Like, who cares, really?
It is fairly germane right now.
But it need, like, it's, so it's March 18th today, which is important because who knows where we're going to be tomorrow, the next day, a week from now. You know, like, it's wild out there.
Yeah.
So what are you doing? I mean, I know you have a family, you have kids. You like, got through the end of your dates, right, with the 311 day?
Yeah, it was just right down to the wire. You know, we certainly didn't want to put anyone in any kind of danger, but people had already traveled from all over the world, really. So it's like, well, we're already here. So, you know, it's just a unique situation that, so yeah, we got to finish the shows, and it added, what was already a crazy energy situation, just this heightened sense of energy. And I think more a community where everyone was like, right. Wow, we get to be together now, and maybe who knows when the next time is, you know, because it was starting to come out at the same time, like concerts are shutting down, gatherings of all kinds are shutting down. So we kind of had like one last hurrah.
Exactly. Exactly. That's a good way to put it. Yeah, you're right. Especially doing the shows in Las Vegas, like all those people have traveled. I mean, sure, there's people from Las Vegas, but not that many. Probably less than half the people there, I'd say. So, you know, those people are going to be out in a hotel, on the strip, like in casinos, whatever. Like, they're still going to be in a, you know, a non-self-distancing environment regardless. So, but it's, you know, the time frame, too. People have to remember, like, this is like 100 years ago, which is a.k.a. last week. right? Like, everything has changed. Yeah. So, like, my band, we were on tour as well. We had to postpone the whole thing. And, you know, we had, last show was on Wednesday. And then we had Thursday off. And literally that Thursday, just watching everything evolve, like in the morning being like, yeah, we'll probably get through the weekend, maybe even through next week. But I don't know about California, into like, no, shut it all down, like right now. And, you know, postponing the rest and going back up north instead of heading down to play on Friday. And it seems like Friday was like the last time anyone really played a show. And that happened to be the end of your run, which is, that's some luck right there.
we just so under the wire, and hearing from all these other bands like yours, like shows canceled and stuff. So now we just hunkered down and taking care of family, homeschooling, cooking, making sure we have the right amount, you know, have food, but don't overbuy to cause other people shortages. So,
well, yeah, with three, you have three girls, right?
Yeah.
Your toilet paper is stocked up, I hope.
Yeah, that we're good on.
Because my sister, she's got three. She lives in Las Vegas. She has three kids as well, and she's run out. And she's like, "This is I don't know what to do." I'm like, "You gotta have to ask the neighbors. I don't know. Like, you're gonna have to barter some other paper product or so. I don't know what you do in this day and age. It's the weirdest thing, right? Like, I'll be fine. It's just me and my girlfriend. We'll have to take a shower after we take shits or whatever. I mean, we'll make it work if we run out. But if you have a family with kids, like, it's actually a real problem.
Yeah.
Damn, dude. Anyway, man. So, yeah, you're hunkering down. I assume you're so prolific. I mean, with your music, so many albums over so many years. Does this give you some time to maybe come up with a 14th 311 album?
I mean, it's certainly given me a lot to think about. And songwriting is processing, you know, saying what needs to be said. And so, I think some stuff will come out of it, and just the perspective of, okay, what's really important here? Like, we've got our loved ones and our relationships, and it's a reset. Like, okay, yeah, on the short term, we need toilet paper, but big picture, what do we really need? And that's like to make sure that our loved ones are okay, and getting down to this super sort of basic, human species level, it's quite intense. Lots to think about, and definitely lots will come out in the songwriting eventually.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, yeah, it's hard to know really what to do. I mean, that's the key. I mean, you guys have, you know, what is this, like, going to be your 21st year in a row headlining Sheds in the summer, right? Something like that?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a staple for you. You do that every year. I mean, that's like clockwork. You know, it's kind of like your work slash vacation slash your whatever, right? And there's a chance that could not happen.
Yeah. Last summer we took off was 1998. We've toured every summer since then.
Wow.
And we're looking forward to having a 30th anniversary tour. So how that's going to look,
yes,
we'll see.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I saw you were going to do 50 dates in 50 states. Yeah. Have you done all 50 states before? I assume probably.
We have. We finally played Alaska and finished out the list about 8 years ago. But now to do it in 1 year, all 50 states is going to be a task.
Yeah. I mean,
requires some creative rescheduling probably because everything is shuttered.
Yes. I mean, that's insane. Yeah. That's hard enough to pull off. Like, I'm sure when you went to your agent and you were like, hey, so we want to do this, your agent was like, oh God, really? Like, you have to play New Hampshire, like Massachusetts is going to be better. Just play there. You know, no offense to anybody listening from New Hampshire, right? Like, cause my band still hasn't done all 50. The two were missing, which are kind of strange. I think we've never played New Hampshire ever, 20 years, and we've never played Mississippi. So we've played all the other ones, but and every time we hit up our agent, we're like, hey, can we maybe just play New Hampshire? They're like, come on, the show, you know, show in Massachusetts will be better, show in Connecticut will be better. We're like, okay, fine, you win.
Yeah.
So my apologies to those people having to drive every single time. I had a question real quick that I almost forgot about. Is it true that you own an island?
No, that was back before I had a family. And yes, I did have a really cool place.
Oh, you did own an island?
Florida Keys, long time ago.
Oh, cool. Right. No, I just thought of that because I remember hearing that like years ago, and it was kind of before you could fact check stuff on the internet.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I was like, is that true? Like, that sounds like he's got a private island. Wow. And now I'm thinking about it. I'm like, man, that would be probably a pretty good place for viral control. If you were so
hide out
inclined
and just live on snapper and stuff that I catch off the dock, that would that would be cool. But no, I'm home in LA and Topanga.
That's funny. Cool. Well, so can we go back and talk about some of the old days? I don't know. Some artists love talking about it. Some artists don't. But you know, you have such a cool beginning, being from a place that is not known for, you know, a high output of rock bands, of music. But you guys started out with this indie sensibility, which in the 80s was not super common yet. Like the indie label, you know, thing that happened in the 90s, it kind of hadn't happened yet. Yeah. But you really took it upon yourself to kind of start there with, you know, putting out your own music and making a name for yourself.
Yeah. We were inspired by the groundbreaking people like, you know, Sub Pop Records. And, you know, our first gig was opening for Fugazi. And they, of course, are like a total cottage industry that just do everything themselves. Like,
wow. Is that true? Fugazi? Fugazi was the intro of this podcast for 100 episodes, actually.
Amazing.
Now it's Bad Brains. But that's insane. I had no idea it was your first show was with Fugazi.
Yeah, it was such a lucky thing that Pina, our bass player, heard about, hey, they're looking for opening punkish bands for when they play Sokol Hall, which is this rundown, awesome old hall that's still there today. We play there again on our 25-year anniversary. And it was our first gig. But we were just realize, you know, we just need to get a recording of our music, get it to cassette, sell the tapes on consignment at record stores, sell the tapes at shows, and then those songs basically became hits in our local fans' minds, and they shared it with everybody right. else, and then our shows got bigger and bigger, and but yeah, there was a bit of a, oh, that band's from Omaha, they can't be cool, because everything cool at that time was from the coast or whatever, but yeah. we just knew we had something special and stuck to it. And then, you know, certain cities kind of become a scene, like, you know, Minneapolis or and then Omaha did become more of a scene after our band. But yeah, we were kind of treading uncharted territory from then. But, you know, we've enjoyed living on the coast for, you know, moving to LA. But
yeah,
we didn't need to. You don't have to move anywhere to make it. You just got to start working on building a fan base.
Especially not now. You don't have to move. And the idea of, we've talked about it on this podcast a little bit, but the idea of a scene, the idea of areas, you know, you used to be able to listen to a band and be like, oh, like that's a band from Southern California, or that's a band from New York City. You know, like the New York bands were heavier. The California bands were maybe, you know, maybe there was ska in their music or reggae, or it was, you know, like more in major keys. That's gone now. I mean, there's yeah. usually the bands are just from Ohio or something, typically. So, yeah. So the idea of music spreading, you know, with cassettes and people copying cassettes off each other, it's so hard for people now in this, I call it the digital age, but it's so beyond that, for people to understand, you know, like copying literally analog tapes, dubbing them at high speeds, or some people didn't even have that technology, so they had to do it at, you know, real-time speeds. Isn't it crazy to think that how much harder it was for you at the time? Why do you think it was, you know, you were able to get that success? Is it just because no one else was doing it?
I guess we were just relentless. You
right.
know, you got to keep getting up each day and, you know, thinking like, all right, what can I do to further the goal? And usually it's booking shows and making new music. But yeah, you got to definitely be relentless and not rely on some manager or someone else to do it for you.
Right. Well, you're still relentless. That's a great word for your band. I mean, you guys have not stopped. You mentioned your last summer off was 1998. I mean, we talk about the amphitheater tours, the cruises, all the other stuff that you've done. And one thing now that you've created is this insane cult following. You know, whether your music is selling a ton, whether it's getting played on the radio at any given moment or it's not, whether they're supporting it or not, you still have this core group of fans, which is, I mean, pretty, I don't want to say unheard of, because there are a lot of bands that have great fan bases, but for you to be cemented yourself as this entity, you know, in so many people's minds, that's always there, that's a pretty special thing.
Oh, yeah. It's a couple years ago when we put out Mosaic, one of the big publications said that we're one of America's biggest cult bands. And I was like, God, we kind of are. That's pretty... It's a nice category to be in, because it means you just kind of do your own thing and have your own little microcosm. And
right.
we want to keep doing that rather than trying to participate in someone else's scene. We just kind of have our own happy cult, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, you could argue, or people could argue, that you always have, you know, been your own scene, your own band. No one really sounds like you. You know, you've pretty much made music with no rules for 30 years.
Yeah, we got a thrill out of breaking down barriers and making new combinations that hadn't been done before.
So what's your background? I mean, to jump around a little bit, I mean, you're from the middle of the country. Were your parents musicians? Did you have brothers and sisters? Like, what were you listening to that kind of created all these influences in your head that, you know, churns out 311 songs?
Well, I started piano when I was five, and my parents were both decent amateur musicians. My mom more than my dad. My mom had a cool jazz band in college where she would play at big dances and stuff like that. You know, just singing the kind of standards of the time. So she, you know, I got a lot from her, but more just being music fans of putting on a Ray Charles album or, and just having music as kind of part of our, like on Saturdays when they'd clean the house and we'd crank up 50s music. Like that was just, it was just a source of joy. And I was just attracted to the rebellion of rock and roll. And I think that I was just hooked, and I didn't really, it was more of a self. I mean, I took piano lessons, but it really took off when I was 13 and I got my first guitar, and then I just started being able to figure out songs by putting on records. And I had a guitar teacher who was very self-taught. He was like, just listen, see, this is a C chord. And I, oh, okay. And just sounding stuff out and then just doing covers. Like me and Tim, our guitarist, had a cover band in high school where we were playing all the, what were college rock hits at the time, which were bands like REM and The Cure and The Smiths and pretty like underground stuff that they didn't play on the radio that the cool kids knew about in, you know, mid 80s Omaha. And then I heard more of this kind of hybrid music, which is like when I heard the Chili Peppers and Jane's Addiction and Fishbone and Faith No More and these different bands that were just having punk rock intensity, but also good musicianship and writing good songs. And it was, I was like, oh yeah, that's where I want to go. That's for me. And then just getting lucky and having the band members that I encountered who became my biggest influences. You know what I mean? Like people say, who are your influences? Well, the guys in my band, that those are my influences.
Yes.
Whether you like it or not, they have to be, you know?
Well, you've kept together. You know, go ahead. Yes. Sorry.
Unfortunately, I was, you know, with luck, had some super talented, creative guys that I had known from the high school days in Omaha. And because I had floundered around in LA trying to get a band going, and it just wasn't the same as a band from with my homies, you know? So,
yeah.
It worked out really nicely. I'm super grateful because it could have gone in many different ways.
So when did you go out to LA and try to, you know, do that? I picture, you know, it's like something out of a movie where that kid from the Midwest shows up in LA, you know, like that, like, oh, that guy's got a mohawk. What's that guy's got a pier? That girl's got a crazy pierce, you know, like in whatever year that was. How did that all happen?
Yeah, it was 1988 and I graduated early from high school. And I remember my guidance counselor, I was like, I need to graduate so I can go get going on my music career. He was like, no, I don't think it's a good idea. And I was like, oh, technically, can you stop me? He was like, no. Okay. So I took one like summer school math class so I could be done with my credits. And I was 17, about to turn 18. And I just moved out to LA by myself. And I thought, well, downtown LA must be where all the action is because downtown is the cool part. And it was at that point in 1988, LA was downtown was a ghost town. So I quickly relocated to work right by the Guitar Center in Hollywood on Sunset Boulevard and just getting into the real musician scene. And I learned a lot and got to meet some of my heroes because I was working at the biggest, hottest music store. And so getting to like meet like Stevie Wonder and the guys from Chili Peppers and Jane's Addiction and Guns N' Roses would come in there and buy it. And I was like, okay, wow, this is, you know, this is the epicenter of what's going on right now. But I just didn't really find the right musicians to click with. And then, so kind of reorganized, went back to Omaha, started 311 and built it up through grassroots means.
So it was some kind of a crash course you had over there, that I'm sure you'd learned so much. That's the thing too. Like it's always hard to compare, even for me. Like I would only been 7 years old in 1988, but I still, you know, I'm old enough to remember recording music on tape and waiting it for it to rewind between takes, and you know, stuff like that that people take for granted now. But what people take for granted now is, like, sure, you can probably do a couple internet searches and figure out where to live in LA. But in 1988, how are you going to fucking know where to go?
No.
I would have done the same thing. I don't know, downtown, sure.
Yeah,
like, it's cheap.
And
let's
then
get
once
an apartment
you get here,
there.
And you got to use a Thomas Guide, which is like this huge book to find any address. And it was crazy. And also just in touring in the 90s, when we would have like a road atlas to figure out where to go to the next city. And, you know, we would have, I would be driving the RV and like Tim would be navigating, say, turn left here. And it was just crazy how that we got it done. You know what I mean?
I know. It's like you forget, but it is funny. When like there were times when you missed 75 and you got on 94 and you drove it like, you know, 2 hours the wrong way. And you're like, shit,
totally.
we're going to be late for load in.
Exactly.
I know. Or like the idea of pulling, like we used to pull the van over to get to like, use a payphone to call our record label Collect to connect with like an interview we had to do, and then we're just at the side of the road for like 30 minutes while I did an interview or something. Like, that stuff is so crazy to think about.
Oh yeah, standing around at payphones and always having that calling card that you had everything memorized so you could dial it yourself. It was like 32 numbers in a row to make a phone call.
It's so true. I remember the first time I saw a band. It was a band opening for us, and they had a GPS. I don't know what year this would have been, maybe like 2004 or something. And it blew my fucking mind. Like what? How does it know where you are? Like, I still don't get how it knows where you are.
Yeah.
These things didn't have internet. They just plugged into the cigarette lighter.
Yeah.
It was crazy. Man, that's crazy. So when you worked at Guitar Center in LA and you met all these people, Stevie Wonder and Guns N' Roses and whoever else you talked about, did you ever run into those guys like 15 years later and say, hey, do you remember that kid you bought that Les Paul from? Like, did that ever happen?
I think when I recorded with Flea on the working with Joe Strummer, I told him that story. I was like, you may not remember this, but I met you back at Guitar Center when I was working there. He was super nice. I don't think you remember it, though.
Wow, that might not be your fault. I mean, I read Anthony Kiedis' book, and it seemed like they were pretty fucked up.
They were wild.
For decades.
They were wild.
Yeah, they were wild. That's crazy. So to finish the kind of the history a little bit, so you go back to Omaha, you get back with your buds, and, you know, I guess you start making tapes and you end up getting signed. And then, you know, it's time to put out the debut record. What was that like?
Well, God, just the excitement of getting to record in a big studio, because we did our first recordings at Cherokee Studio on Fairfax. And they're like, you guys remember the Michael Jackson, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough drum sound? It was recorded in this room. We were like, no way. A debut album is kind of like a greatest hits of all your ideas from your teenage years and everything. So that's why a lot of debuts are really good. And we just couldn't wait for people to hear it. We were lucky that even though at first we did start out in true grassroots means, those first 2 years we were just selling tapes, and then we finally got to go to CD and stuff like that. But, you know, landing a deal made it all so much easier.
So we could talk about Down for a minute. I mean, obviously that was the first track on the first record. It was the breakthrough hit.
That was actually on our third album.
Oh, right. Sorry. Yep. But your breakthrough hit, like on your first major label album.
Yeah.
No, I know. I know the history. Don't worry. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that being the breakthrough record and that song, but it wasn't the first single released.
Third single.
You guys think that was, exactly, did you guys think, or did the label think that that was going to be the song that was going to be the one?
No.
And especially all these years later?
I kept telling them Down is the one. They're like, oh, we want to go with Don't Stay Home first. And then they went with All Mixed Up. And then finally we talked them into going with Down third. And then that what got like a buzz clip on MTV, which is at the time, yeah, was like, this is what everyone's talking about. And then things just really took off. Like the show's changed so much where, I mean, we already had a young fan base, but then it got really young. And it was an exciting time just to be like the chanting and everything, like before we got even on stage, the amount of intensity, like people starting a mosh pit before we even got on there, even just to like the walk on music, we'd have some Bob Marley playing and like they're moshing because they're just so fucking excited for you to come out there.
I love that. I remember one time I saw like NoFX when I was maybe like 14 or 15, and every, you know, I'm in the front row, and the drum tech comes out to like check the drums. And he does, like, you know, the NoFX, like, really fast punk beat,
yeah,
like the double time punk beat. And he just plays that for, like, I don't know, 15 seconds. And there's a circle pit. People are going around. It's like,
they're like, there's our
I
cue.
Love, right? That beat's coming. I know it's coming. We're going to hear that for the next 45 minutes. Yeah, it's funny how that, I love that story. You know, being with the same guys in your band for so many years, you know, I'm sure you get asked all the time, oh, what's your secret or whatever. I'm not as interested in that as interested in just the fact that you were literally kids, you know, that weren't able to drink, and, you know, you've grown up together and now you're adults with families and everything else. That's kind of a wild ride.
Oh, yeah.
You ever think about that?
Oh, yeah. To go from no responsibility and at all to like, okay, now this is a big thing. Like we've got a lot of employees and people counting on us. And then of course the next level of to have a family, and it is totally different than it was. I mean, it was kind of a nonstop party in those first few years. And we're like, okay, now I was like, I better wait to smoke weed and drink until after the shows, because this is important.
okay, so you guys had, I mean, it seems like you've got a pretty good head on your shoulders, you know, and some good work ethic that you seemingly have always had. Is that something that you guys have always had with each other? I mean, it seems like you guys have been pretty, I don't know the word, I mean, you guys have never been in any trouble. I mean, you know, I never heard of anyone in your band going to rehab or anything like that. It seems like you guys have a really great support system for one another.
Yeah, I think we keep a family vibe going. You know, it's a extended family. It's a brotherhood. And then now having our kids be friends and wives and stuff like that, it's pretty it's a special vibe, but you know, everybody kind of needs to have a community, and ours has been luckily that it's kind of both what we do for a living and for friendship and for fun is all kind of the same thing. So we're super, super lucky and thinking about that kind of stuff a lot as we hit 30 years.
Yeah. Geez, 30 years. You know, you talk about smoking weed there for a second, and your band has always been huge marijuana enthusiasts, supporters. How have you seen that evolve so much from that, probably that take being so controversial when you started, to now it being legal for, I assume, a majority of the U.S. population? How has that been, that transition? Have you noticed anything?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think at one point people were associating that with us so much that we started to get kind of like shy away from it just a tiny bit. Cause it's like, well, that's not all we do is smoke weed. We're putting lots of thought into what we're doing here. But then, yeah, now to see that the culture has become accepted, and, you know, I guess at the time I was like, really into the injustice of why are these people being locked up for something that's safer than alcohol? why, you know, it was something we did talk right. about, and we were risking kind of a lot. We had to, you know, get out of some dicey situations here and there, but, you know, luckily nothing really.
Especially with a young, especially with a young fan base, right?
Yeah.
Like you talked about.
Yeah. And now it's cool to be able to make our own cannabis products. And, you know, I'm very into sourcing really good CBD for, first started out for my mom who was, went through a cancer treatment, and then now to have those available, through mail order to, and for like pets, CBD, it's nice to be able to have something we were always into be legal and accepted and people acknowledge like, okay, this shouldn't, we shouldn't be locking up people for this.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, man. I want to ask you about a couple more songs, if you don't mind. One of my personal favorites is a song from 2005 called Don't Tread on Me. And I have literally had that song stuck in my head for 15 years. I swear, man. We were out recording a record in California, and I think K-Rock was playing the track like right when it came out. I think it was 2005. And I just heard that song on the radio, and I swear I'll just wake up some days and I'll just have that song in my head. I'm surprised. I mean, I know that was a, you know, big song at the time. I mean, it's not in your top 10 on Spotify or anything, but I still think it's one of your best songs. How do you feel about that song?
Good. We played it at 311 Day last week.
Cool.
But it isn't in our rotation heavily. I don't know why, but I think I do have mixed feelings about it because it sounds kind of defensive, but that's where how I was feeling at the time. Like,
right.
You know, don't judge me, look at your own shit. So that type of sentiment that's in there, it's not like what I would like on my tombstone or anything, but it was, you know, at the time there was a lot of division going on in the world and, you know, post 9/11, it was just a crazy time. And, I was kind of just reacting to all the division, but yeah, the chord progression, I think it kind of reminds me a little bit of, a Billie Holiday song. Which one is escaping me right now? I can't put a finger on it,
okay.
But it's just
okay.
Like a very classic kind of chord progression to go from like C major to E major, that like major third, instead of usually go to the
right.
minor chord. And it just creates a sort of a classic timeless,
I mean,
vibe.
That could be why it's stuck in my head. Right. Mm-hmm. It's like when you go from you're right. When you have a C chord and then you go into the E, when you go from like a G to a G major note, from a G to a G sharp, you know, all of a sudden it's
a
like,
yeah,
yeah, it's this like augment that you're like, what?
Yeah.
And maybe that's what it is that grabs me so much. But I swear, like that song, I don't know what it is about it, man. But going down the other song list, I've never done this before, but I think this is cool to ask you some stuff. What about the song Beautiful Disaster?
You know, you mentioned NoFX earlier. I was listening to a ton of NoFX at the time, and also the band The Urge from St. Louis.
Yeah.
So if that's kind of, if you take those two influences, and I don't know, it's hard to put a finger on like what in Beautiful Disaster sounds like NoFX, but I just know that I was listening to, was it Punk and Drublick? I think was the album at the time,
yeah,
a lot.
Sure.
And then also with The Urge, they had these really cool long horn lines that would start each song. So I did that except on guitar with the dual lead harmonizing lead guitars, that it was kind of like a horn arrangement except on distortion guitar. And I don't know, I think it was really painted a picture of some crazy relationship that I was in at the time. It was like somebody like, I'm fascinated by this chick, but I know I shouldn't be with her because she's a total train wreck. And I think we've all known people like that.
Sure.
So it tells a story for sure.
That record being your, well, your let's be right here. It's your fourth album,
right?
But your, you know, your follow up to your smash hit album, was there a lot of pressure? I mean, that was a big song at a time you probably needed a big song.
Yeah, the truth is,
and I know it's hard to think about when you're going back, but it is something we talk about too on the show, how that album is so important in a career.
It was a pivotal time, and we reacted in an unusual way, which was that after the Blue album, our third album, was all condensed as far as short, punchy, high energy songs. And we had some more experimental stuff, but those all went on the B-sides that came out like on our Enlarge to Show Detail video.
Right.
So people were expecting something that was going to be like Mosh Pit ready, but we were like, all right, let's go fucking weird on Transistor and just don't worry if it's going to be good live or not, and just go as in down as esoteric of a rabbit hole as we can find. And we were all kind of into trip hop at the time, which was like Massive Attack and Tricky and Portishead and these kind of dub influenced. They also, acid jazz was a thing they called it then. And it was just combining hip hop with different weird ingredients. So there's a lot of what I would call trip hop influenced stuff on their songs, like Prisoner. That was definitely like, I was just trying to get as dubby as possible. Mm-hmm. And then there was a couple rockers, like the song What Was I Thinking? This is just a balls to the wall kind of funk throwdown. But there's only a few. It was a 21 song album, and only a few of them were rockers. So we had a lot of mellower stuff. And at first, it really was not well received at all. People were like, what happened to 311? They used to rock.
Right.
But then after a while, people realize, oh, there's some creativity gone into this, and started to appreciate it. So to go from it being now our most beloved album, a lot of our fans picked that as their favorite, but it was widely panned at the time.
Hmm. That's interesting how that happens.
Yeah.
And I want to ask you about Amber too, because that song has become such a huge song. I mean, crossover, you know, to a lot of different, you know, radio and stuff, it gets played. But it's a bit of a deep cut on the album. Did you know that one was going to be something special?
Yeah, I felt it was the one that I was like, I still think Amber might be the one, you guys. And it was our third single.
Again.
Yeah.
Right? It's a pattern.
Yeah. But now, you know, we've said that before, but now you don't even get to a third single because the album cycles are so much faster and culture just moves on. It's basically first single and out. You know what I mean? Yeah. But I just wanted to make as mellow of tones as possible and have like the lyrics and all the audio tones that you're hearing just be as like soft and mellow, like the color amber, the color of a sunset. It's softer on the prism scale. Like, you know, you can look at a sunset though, but you can't look like at a blue light or something like that. So that's just kind of where I was going with it.
Cool. I love that. I love that so much. Well, man, I guess I'd ask you what's going on next, you know, what to tell the people, but I guess there's just so much doubt right now. I don't know if you have an answer.
Yeah, no, I have no idea.
So what are you, you're spending your days inside with the family, and I assume your kids aren't going to school or anything?
No. So we just kind of,
that's all done.
Split the day up with like learning time, outside play time, you know, family time, movies. But I just, in the morning I'll be like, how's my Corona buddy? Cause we're all like Corona buddies now. Just say, whoever you're hunkering down with, that's your Corona buddy. So, we just got to enjoy it and take care of each other and, you know, be of service as far as like providing comfort for other people, take care of ourselves as well as someone else, you know?
Absolutely. Anything else I missed before I let you go?
No, it was a fun conversation. Thanks for doing it.
Thanks, man. Thank you so much. Are you guys planning on doing cruises anymore? Actually, that's one question I forgot.
Yeah.
Because I know you skipped the last one. And I mean, obviously, cruise industry, who knows what's going to happen. But
true. But we're on it. Everything's been on schedule so far because we rotate 1 year. Like even number years like this is 311-day year. And odd number years are cruise years. And we've been keeping them going for like the past 10 years. So we're going to hopefully continue that.
Yeah, I hope you do. I hope we can. And I hope this just kind of fades away and we forget about it. I don't think it's happening at this point, but I'm going to just be the king of wishful thinking there. And yeah. Well, I'm going to leave the people with a tune. My pick is Space and Time. How about that? You like that for a final track?
Sounds great. Enjoy it.
All right, man. Nick, thank you so much for taking the time and all the best with everything, man.
Same to you. Take care.
From 311, from the latest album Voyager, that is Space and Time. I want to thank Nick so much for taking the time to speak with me. I'm really glad that they got those shows in before the planet melted down, and hopefully they aren't going to break this streak. What is it, 21 in a row? Oh my goodness, yes. So hopefully those shows go off this summer as well, and we can all get back out there. And we can play music with our friends, because that's pretty much what guys like me and Nick, that's all we know how to do. Anyway, thank you so much for tuning in. If you like the show, check out the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club, leadsingersyndrome.com/all access. Tell a friend, tell a loved one. I got other really great guests too. Go back, listen to some old episodes if you got the time, which you just might. Well, I gotta play it, right? The song that was stuck in my head for literally 15 years? It's still in my head right now. There's a possibility. That melody, for some reason, just does not leave my head. So here it is. I'll leave you with one more. Don't Tread on Me by 311 on Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love. We'll see you next time.